Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 628, August 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and this episode is the first in a series, not all in a row, because nonlinear is the way to go with this. Maybe it's not even the first. I shouldn't even say that. It is one in a series that could be listened to in any order you wish of what we are calling the summer of time travel.
It's important to remember, though, Jason, that the time flow in San Dimas is always going.
It's always going.
Always going.
So the
we're calling it, we called it, and we will call it one day.
We will. In
the
fact, this may
travel,
be the
dude.
Future us from another summer of time travel going back to this summer of time travel, which may extend into the fall. Doesn't matter. Still the summer
Give
of time travel.
Give our love to the princesses.
Indeed. So those voices, I'm going to introduce them. They all said things already before, thereby violating the sacred code of being silent until you're introduced.
We're nonlinear, dude.
Because
it's
we're
cool.
All nonlinear.
We'll go back in time and fix
Let
it
Let me
in
thank
post.
My panelists for going to be here. Steve Lutz is here. Hi, Steve.
Want a Twinkie, Genghis Khan?
Kelly Gamont is here. Hello.
Gentlemen, I'm here to help you with your history report.
Oh, my.
Lisa Schmeiser joins us. Hi, Lisa.
Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
And Moises Gian is here. Hi.
Jason, I have to come clean, dude. I'm not actually present Moises. I'm Moises from 2 years from now. And I remember that we us said what we us are saying right now, dude.
Whoa.
Oh, man.
Whoa.
How racist are we about to be, dude?
Only as misogynistic as we are, dude.
Okay, cool. If you can warn us in advance, then maybe we'll probably still do it. Never mind.
That's right. Wind your watch. Just
Don't
wind
forget
your watch.
To wind your watch, Moises.
If you didn't get all those references, we are talking about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, a film from 1989 in which Bill and Ted have an excellent adventure in time.
What?
And therefore, it's the summer of time travel, which I already introduced. Or will I?
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Dude.
This comes from the era of film when you could make a movie about two morons saying party on, and it would get widely released in theaters.
Happened multiple times.
But it almost didn't. This movie almost didn't get released because the production company had like massive catastrophic problems right after they finished making it. And they thought, Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves thought that this movie was never going to get released and that they just were part of something special that no one was going to ever get. No one was ever going to get to see because it got HBO Maxed. Before it actually,
yeah,
got
I was going
to
say it's they're going to take a write down on their taxes instead of releasing it.
Yeah, no, literally that was basically the whole thing. Was the company was completely defunct, and nobody wanted to buy some movie that hadn't been tested and had, you know, a bunch of money attached to it, and those guys were busy fleeing creditors.
And again, the great two morons saying party on genre, capped by Wayne's World and Wayne's World 2, but
sure.
It's here too. And
well, there's a third Bill and Ted movie now as well.
And there is
so
a third Bill
really.
And Ted movie that was released a couple years ago. But we're just going to talk about the first, the original, the classic. You got to start with the classics.
Yes.
And so this
I
is
mean,
a movie.
You can't go wrong with the time traveling phone booth, Jason.
Look,
you can't.
It'll make sense. I'm a professional.
Yeah, sure.
So
I don't know what those two things have to do with each other.
Basically, in the year 2688, the Earth is a paradise. George Carlin, especially our narrator and also a character in the movie, assures us things are great. But the problem is that it's a society based entirely on the good works of Bill and Ted. the two morons were about to meet in 1988.
This is a heavily bowling and mini golf and water slide based society.
Uh-huh. It's a paradise on
Which
Earth.
Is perfect. Yes. It's perfect.
And they've spread the good word around the galaxy to all
and
other
George
civilizations.
And George Carlin based as well, which is a great get and also a very strange get.
Mm-hmm.
But he's great in this.
Does anyone have the origin story for how George Carlin agreed to be attached to this movie or why he chose this movie?
They tried getting a bunch of other people. Like, they actually went for Charlie Sheen, Sean Connery, who was more out of their reach than Charlie Sheen.
I don't know who was drinking just there, but I'm sorry you just got it squirted out your nose.
No, I just really love the idea of reaching for the dude who was in Highlander with, hey, you've already played an immortal on one end. What we'd like you to do is a time travel movie now.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, Carlin, one of the producers worked with him on something or another, and they were like, hey, would you do this? And he was like, yeah, sure, why not?
And sounds like fun.
They were looking for a Rufus. They were looking for a Rufus for way longer than casting any other part in the movie, and they eventually got Carlin, and he's perfect. I think he is a wonderful person to play what I consider the Doctor in the American adaptation of Doctor Who.
I seem to recall they said they'd already started filming when they got him to say okay. Like, by the time they had coordinated everything for him to do it, like, they were already in process.
Yeah, they were already doing principal photography on the movie. I think they were shooting in Italy at the time. They shot part of it in Italy, which is how they got a bunch of these cool-looking locations. They convinced Dino De Laurentiis that them calling each other dude was a show of their masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he understood the movie. He was like, fine, go use the castle. I don't care.
Men can use the castle.
we have to go to Italy. There are many steps and columns.
It's most tranquil there.
Oh, most tranquil.
It is most tranquil.
So the conceit of this movie is that these morons are going to be important. And also, this is how I know where San Dimas is. So.
Serious? Oh, I guess that's right. You're Northern California.
Yeah, that's right. I had no idea.
You had not been steeped in the joy of raging waters for your entire youth before.
No,
this movie
the
came
coded,
out.
Yeah. Well, raging, wasn't there a raging waters in Irvine too? But yeah, this is the coded.
No, that was something else. Something, Oasis
prancing,
or something.
Prancing fluids.
Yeah. Oh, that's it. Yes.
Well, legally
that's,
distinct.
That's something else entirely.
If a home of the it's where the 10 and the 210 meet in San Dimas, right, Steve?
That's right.
I know that.
They're absolutely right.
I'm not going to stop beating the drum that this is the American adaptation of Doctor Who, because, of course, Americans would adapt Doctor Who where they're like, the Doctor, who wants to see him? Everybody wants to see the Doctor's idiot companions on whom the future completely rests.
Completely rests. So we will get to the telephone booth that is the time machine in this in a moment. But first, we've got to have the thing where they play their instruments badly, and they go around in circles, and they do the little air guitar, and the sound effect comes out, and they have the really leaden dialogue, like, we gotta go where school, dude. Oh yeah, they are extremely dumb and kind of limp, and I feel like this movie doesn't really go anywhere until it starts going somewhere when George Carlin shows up, because he's interesting. And I'm gonna just throw out my theory about the Bill and Ted movies now, having not seen the third one, but I've seen the first two. That I think these movies take flight with the minor characters who are doing bits, because I love the minor characters who do bits. William Sadler in the second movie as Death is the greatest thing.
He
in
makes it worthwhile.
Movies from the 90s, I think he is great.
I've got good news for you, Jason. He's in the third movie too.
But that's because he was that good. But in this one, like these early scenes where it's just two morons being morons, I find it very painful.
Yeah,
it's
I would go so far as to say excruciating for this first scene. And that's only added to by the fact that before I ever saw this film, I remember seeing like the poster for it when I was at some theater watching something else. And it's the phone booth and then ridiculously dressed up, clownish looking Keanu Reeves, like writing it, and the wacky fonted Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And I looked at it and I said, that is not a thing that I will ever see, because that looks like the dumbest thing that has ever been released into cinemas. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, somebody who I trusted saw this movie somehow and told me, no, it's really good. You got to go see it. So I did go and see it. But I remember this opening scene unfolding and me thinking, oh no, I was exactly right. This is the worst thing ever. But the good news is that and to defend Bill and Ted themselves for a moment, I mean they're ridiculous idiots and morons, and their little bits where they're like doing the air guitar and the little plays and all that stuff would be horribly painful, as it is in this scene throughout the entire film, except that both Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves absolutely put everything into these performances.
Except that it's Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves. If it were anybody else, it would be really hard to watch them through the rest of the film.
Can we agree that they're morons?
Yes,
but
yes.
They're not. But they're not malicious.
Exactly. Right.
They're very charming. Right. They're very charming. They are very optimistic.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I found tremendously appealing about revisiting this movie, we've been on a little bit of an 80s kick in the house and watching a lot of John Hughes and some of the stuff from the National Lampoon writers. And then when we watched this, it was really very striking, like how polite these two idiots are, and just how when they get Napoleon Bonaparte, they're like, let's have someone take him to a water park and show him a good time. You have what are basically two really sweet, really stupid people, sure, who are modeling a way to treat people from different walks of life with a lot of humanity and respect. And that kind of gets lost in the rest of the chaos of the movie. But like the fact that Keanu Reeves spends 90 minutes saying respectfully, "Are you okay, Mr. the Kid?" Like, yeah, I think it's just, it's kind of an amazing choice that they made to go in that direction with, right, these two idiots instead of making everybody else the butt of the dummy's, right, jokes.
They're good natured, sure, idiots.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's exactly the thing that I have always loved about this movie, and like I'm sure at some point we'll get into just how much Kelly loves this movie, special road trips to go see San Dimas High School, both in San Dimas and the one in Arizona where they actually filmed it. I've been to the San Dimas Mall, which is actually outside of Phoenix, I think, before they tore it down. I ate the cereal. I still have one of the phone booth toys that came with the cereal that you could put cassette tapes in.
You watch the cartoon.
Ask your parents.
Technically, and Phoenix is just outside of San Dimas because the 10 is right there. Anyway.
Sure. Well,
I mean, that too. But one of the things that I love about this movie is that, yes, they're idiots, but they're kind. And I feel, mm-hmm, like they were sort of, yeah, set up at the beginning to be just dumb as posts. And like the rest of the movie, they're not that way. Like you see them coming up with creative solutions. You see them coming up with like, we're going to have everybody chew gum so we can glue the antenna back together.
Oh God, like, that was such a funny sequence.
They do a whole lot of like,
the movie
creative
can't sustain the level of dumbness that the opening scene has, right? Like, it's not possible.
Like you know how kind they are because they thought to pack pudding cups for everybody in their backpack and
yes!
a Nerf football, yeah, for and Socrates and for Socrates and Billy the Kid to play around, mm-hmm, with.
Is everyone okay? They make sure to stop for a snack. They make sure when they, yeah, get back to take them to the mall and get everybody fed. Like, you know, they're on a fundamental
really
level,
weird,
they are caring.
And highly specific skill set. Like, there are no other two people who could probably pull off what they had to pull off.
Also, on a,
exactly,
close, on a close watch, and I know we're here to very closely read Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but it is a podcast about this movie, so I'm going to say it. Also, Alex Winter, like, he's stealthily, and he's, which one is he, Bill or Ted? Come on, remind
he's
me.
Bill.
He's Bill.
He's Bill, right?
He's Bill. Ted, Bill Ted, as Theodore, Preston Esquire.
Ted Theodore Logan is Keanu Reeves. Okay, Bill is smarter than he lets on. That's,
sure,
the other,
yes,
part of it, is it's very clear, yeah, that Bill actually is the one who's always correcting Ted.
Right.
Because Ted is a complete moron.
Yeah.
Bill,
yes,
is,
yes,
like part artifice and not entirely,
yes,
moronic. He's just trying to go along to get along. He's more of just a kind of cool dude who just wants to take it easy.
If you, mm, yeah, and me. Bill is the one who actually comes up with the idea for the report, which is actually brilliant.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who knows that you have to have a poker face when you play poker.
He does. Oh, he has lots
and
of things going for
if
him.
If we... Yeah. It maybe you are the one that stole your dad's keys. If we just do it after the report, then they'll be here.
Oh yeah, he comes,
like,
up.
Yeah,
all that
those
stuff.
Are the things. But
the magical thinking that's introduced that ends up working is entirely Bill's idea.
What I was going to say though about these two lunkheads was that if even for a moment they were seen to be sort of like winking at the camera and saying, "Yeah, we know these guys are dummies, but we're not. We're smart, and we know that this is ridiculous," but they fully invest themselves, mm-hmm, into this, and in the same way that, yeah, like Elf would be intolerable if If Will Ferrell didn't fully invest everything, every stupid movie has into the character and completely buy into it. Both Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves here just absolutely nail these characters. And I think without that, this goes back into being a dumb movie. But
I was thinking about one of my criticisms of the movie is that I think a lot of the dialogue, especially early on, is terrible, and not terrible in a way of it being like they're morons, terrible in the way that it's badly written. And I've seen other movies, because I think the performances save the terrible dialogue, because I think there's probably funnier dialogue for morons to say that this movie can't provide to Bill and Ted. So they kind of have to go by on charm, because the dialogue is, I think, the most painful thing about the first. I mean, the whole movie, it's not great, but the first 20 minutes of it, that's the part that kills me. The performances are fine. They're saving it.
The first 20 minutes, I think, also color the rest of the dialogue in the movie, where the rest of the dialogue in the movie isn't as bad. But because of that first 20 minutes, it has to, the whole movie
to win you
has
back.
To win you over.
Yeah.
Like Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson, who wrote the movie, created these characters as improv characters that they would just answer questions as. And so they were scripting characters that they had previously done improv sketches with.
And it feels worse than improv to me.
I agree. Yes,
that's true.
No one ever time travels to bring back the famous improvs of history.
Exactly. And like a scripted version of improv characters sounds terrible enough on paper that the charm that we've been saying about these characters, that's what ends up winning me over. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm like, you know, this could be Shakespeare and this ain't Shakespeare, you know what, but good enough. I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are bits of clever dialogue and you know, it's few and far between, but there are moments that hit very, very well.
Yeah. Remember when you tried to ask Missy to prom when you were a freshman? Shut up, Ted.
Shut up, Ted.
Like at the time of release, it was compared to movies like Fast Times and others that it has actually nothing in common with other than it has teenage main characters. And
but you've got like a quasi surfer dude who says dude a lot, and so that's apparently
the simple level. I was struck with how many it has music cues from Ghostbusters and Real Genius. It has several camera moves lifted wholesale from Back to the Future, and a special effects budget that I guess like from Doctor Who.
And Jason, believe it or not, it has a tie to another summer of time travel film because it had the exact same production designer as Time Bandits.
Oh, all right. At which you may have already listened to that episode.
Who can say?
Which hasn't been released yet. What? Summer of time travel?
Wow. My mind is blown.
I want to shout out Bernie Casey as the history teacher.
Yes.
Love to see Bernie Casey.
So good.
And boy, are these guys best. You thought these guys were dumb before. Now you see how really, really, I mean, I love that moment where he's like, you guys have completely failed and have lost. You failed to learn anything in my class. It's like, yeah, the world is full of history though, man. Dude, the world is full of history. Like Socratic method. He was great.
And this might be the moment where I perked up the first time I saw it, when I discovered that 80s comedy bit part all-star Bernie Casey was the history teacher. Love him so much.
The one last thing I wanted to say about the guys themselves and how it kind of forms the movie is that after rewatching it this time, I went, now I know how Mike Judge came up with Beavis and Butthead. He said, I'm going to take Bill and Ted and give them no redeeming qualities whatsoever and not even give them an iota of charm. And every moment I give them something that looks like maybe they're going to learn something and become better people or become, you know, the kind of well-adjusted in terms of alignment in a D&D sense that these guys are, they never crest that hill. And that's where Beavis and Butthead came from.
I was struggling with the tone of this movie, and I think I kind of decided that it's trying to kind of be like Back to the Future, except as ridiculous and, you know, as possible, like intentionally ridiculous. Because I had the moment where it's like they kind of are aware of what this movie would be like if they took it seriously, and they know they can't and won't do that. So they go for the, like, we'll just take it to the extreme. And I don't mind it. I think it is what one of the things that makes it charming is that the scene later where they just keep adding people to the telephone booth is just like, that's the movie being like, we don't care. We don't care.
The phone booth was originally a car, because this movie was written before Back to the Future came out.
See, you can't do that. You can't have it be a car.
You can't have it be a car. Once they came time to make the thing, and then they went, well, I guess we'll use a phone booth because we're basically doing a weird version of Doctor Who.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
So we've got the setup, which is they're bad at history and they're going to fail their history test or their oral report that is going to happen at the end of in a bizarre sort of school assembly slash oral report that goes on all day. Don't go to the school, anybody. It sounds terrible.
No.
Yeah,
remember the days back in school when you'd do your final oral report for your history class, you know, in the auditorium in front of the whole school
for several hours.
Nobody else in the school is busy with anything else during finals.
Yeah,
I think it's appropriate that we're talking about the end of the movie at the beginning of the podcast about it. But
it's nonlinear. It's time travel. We're time traveling through the
discussion. Well, that presentation, they originally shot it in Bernie Casey's classroom, but it just didn't work because it was Bill and Ted standing off to the side and the historical characters coming forward and being like, I'm Genghis Khan. And there was nothing dynamic or interesting about it. And they went, what can we do that we can't really explain that'll just look better? And so they put it in an auditorium and it looks great.
Yeah.
So they're going to flunk out if they don't pass their oral report, which they're not, because Bernie Casey says you've learned nothing. And this is why the future is in jeopardy. So they send George Carlin back in time to get them on the right path in his phone booth. And at that point, basically, we enter the next phase of the movie, which is where they are going to be given control of the phone booth. Strange things are afoot at the Circle K because there's a second phone booth and they get non-linearly told by their future selves that they're going to have an excellent adventure, at which point the ping-ponging around history begins. And that's what a large part of the movie is. And this is the point where, I don't know, for me, I looked at this and I thought, okay, it's almost like I'm watching, I don't know, like a Monty Python movie at this point. It is a series of ridiculous sketches about time travel and figures from history, starting with Napoleon, who kind of gets blown into the void
into
of time and
of
space.
History.
The circus
well,
of history.
He's the catalyst
yes.
for the whole thing
yes,
because
modern technology, William.
Falls out of a tree.
That's right.
Jason, do yes. you know when the Mongols ruled China?
12 something. I remember that. That lady in the car 12. At the Circle K oh. told me.
Yeah, that's a great something. Great question. No, that's actually that I was going to make
Marco
that
Polo.
The underrated scene of the movie is the mm-hmm. where they're sitting in the Circle K parking lot. What 7-Eleven wasn't going to pay enough. The Circle K parking lot asking questions about history to passersby
of random people
it's amazing.
In the parking lot.
When did the
lot.
Mongols rule China, lady?
Jason, it's becoming a theme now that I actually know all the historical facts about the movie. It's not 7-Eleven because they couldn't legally clear 7-Eleven and yeah. Circle K said
it's
okay.
Very clear. Like it's the absence is felt there.
But strange things are afoot at the Circle K flows yes. perfectly. It wouldn't have worked as well.
It does.
Where I grew up, there really weren't 7-Elevens. All we had was Circle K. So to me, it totally made sense. So
yeah, I mean, the movie is no Shakespeare, but Shakespeare was no Bill and Ted. Let's be honest.
He's not even in this.
But I love that when they're stuck, their move is to go to a different parking lot in front of
yeah,
a different
store. Yeah,
they're going
to go to the Mighty Mart or something after
yeah,
that.
Yeah, should we try the Mighty Mart? Ask.
But that's yeah. kind of what teenagers do. Like,
well, yeah, but
they got that so right. Despite the fact that Bill and Ted were played by very clearly adult actors at this point.
Yeah.
Like, in keeping with the time-honored 1980s tradition of casting
Dana Carvey.
25-year-olds. Yeah.
40-year-olds, 35-year-olds, whatever old Dana yeah. Carvey was.
Teenagers who can legally rent cars.
Yeah, it was slightly less egregious for the two of them, but yeah, it just yeah. like, and those
Speaking
little
of
moments.
Egregious age range things, they're only at the Circle K because they got kicked out so Bill's dad can molest his child bride in Bill's room.
Oh, that was so
such a creepy moment.
That, yeah.
You couldn't make that joke today, but in the 80s, the idea that there was a student who was so hot she could seduce the faculty, like that was completely, I mean, this movie has some very 80s relics to it.
Say hi for me.
Bill kind of made peace with it too. Like, you know, we get like he's on stage with Freud, goes, "No, I'm good. It's just a minor Oedipal complex." And you know, and they move on.
Good payoff. And there's a knowing nod, little, too, right?
The Sigmund Freud.
Yeah, Bernie Casey looks over at Missy immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm gonna once again go to the defense of the dialogue and the script. Yeah, they're groan-inducing dad jokes, but they work. They all work.
I mean, that's and even it's the little things ones. Like that throughout the movie that I really, I'm always here for the understated, the throwaway line, the quiet running gag through the end, you know,
this
all of that.
This movie holds up weirdly well for something that came out in 1989.
There are a couple of creaky parts. We just covered one of them, but most of the rest of it is not super cringy for the most part.
The dialogue that I have a problem with is when they're trying to establish the dude bona fides of Bill and Ted, and it doesn't work.
And after you watch Napoleon Bonaparte stuff his face with an ice cream sundae, it's you kind of don't
forgiven.
Care about the creek.
After Napoleon Bonaparte learns that the only thing he really needs in life to fill his gaping hole that caused him to try to invade Europe is one, ice cream, and two, water slide.
A water slide.
Ziggy Piggy.
That's it. That's all he needs.
Ziggy Piggy.
Man, if only he could have lived to see 2688, he would have just been...
Oh, boy.
He would have been a Ziggy Piggy and a Pope.
In my headcanon, they bring Napoleon into the future, and that's his great afterlife, as he gets to just do ice cream and water slides.
And water loops.
Waterloo.
I think...
Good joke.
My headcanon was when they got to the end of the report, they just took him back to Waterloo and then dropped everybody else off and then took him later.
It's not that on the nose, by the way. The place is called Water Loops.
They go to the Old West and meet Billy the Kid. And there's a bar fight. I like the fact that they walk through the Old West town and everybody stares at them because they're wearing modern clothes. And
they look like lunatics.
Who are these people? There's a bar fight, and then ultimately they escape with Billy the Kid. Because
ironically, they don't make any. They don't make any bacon about the fact that they're saying "dude" all the time, and that's one of the few places where they could do that and not have an eye batted at them.
Right.
That was sort of a thing I appreciated about that one. Was
we understand these guys. Whereas nobody
poker face, by the way, is amazing. That scene where he says you got to have a poker face, and then his poker face just kills me. It's so ridiculous.
Every time.
He's got the cigar hanging out of his mouth.
I laugh at that so much every time.
Got to have a poker face, dude.
Yeah. I mean, and I also admire Mr. The Kid's entrepreneurial spirit.
Mm-hmm. I also like the fact that they don't play completely fast and loose with the language thing. Like another movie might have everybody speak English. And that's not what they do.
How everyone can understand.
Well,
each other.
There's like Socrates does everything with gestures and stuff.
Right.
Excuse me, Jason. It's pronounced Socrates.
It's under Socrates.
Yes. And then the opening of All Our Children or
Days of Our Lives.
Days of Our Lives. Yes. Like Sands Through the Hourglass.
So,
or the Days of Our Lives.
Which, by the way, was my mom's favorite part of the movie because we saw it in the theater. And she said, I thought that was very funny.
Is Dust in the Wind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dust, wind, dude.
He also loves baseball.
Yep.
I don't know what it is he's trying to gesture there, though. Does anybody have any theories on that?
Nope. Well, maybe he saw Genghis Khan in the sporting goods store and is impressed.
No, I don't think so. I think he was hanging out with Siggy and Billy the Kid at that point, trying to pick up chicks, but we'll get there.
Could be.
Egghead.
They go to medieval times, and there's a castle where they meet historical babes while Socrates and Billy the Kid are throwing around a Nerf football. There's some knight fighting with lightsaber sounds that they make personally because they're fighting each other with swords.
Because high.
Yep. Yeah. Ted falls down and is stabbed to death. It's very sad. You killed Ted, you medieval dickweed. But fortunately, he says in one of those like Fry in Futurama saying, I had another guy. Ted is just standing there and he says, I fell out of the suit of armor when I landed. And it's like...
Yeah, this is so classic serial. No, he jumped out of the car at the last minute. You just didn't see it.
It's fine.
But
he's not dead.
You can just fall
like
out of plate armor.
Like
sands
through the hourglass, you guys.
They hug, at which point we have our little sigh of,
the other creaky piece of
it was another
dialogue.
Time. Anyway, it was another time.
There was 80s movies go and 90s movies too. The homophobia could have been and often was worse.
Well, I would say it was even winking, right? Because the idea is that they obviously care about each other and they give each other hugs. And then they have to do the manly thing of recusing, about any feelings because they're men. Yeah. And then we move on with the story.
We had to pause and have the discussion. Like, we watched this with my 11-year-old daughter and, she was like, excuse me, and made us pause it. And we actually, we had to have a talk about, in the 80s, it was like this. And now it is not. And Jason, like you say, it was basically them being afraid to express authentic affection and emotion for another dude in any context.
They're hanging a lantern on it.
But then they go like right back to being really excited to see each other. And how are we going to get out of this?
Of course they do.
They have the purest friendship. Oh, it's
that
so
they're
pure.
Like, we've checked that box, you know, and now, you know, now that we've admitted that we're not actually feeling romantic about each other, now we can go back to being really excited. Holy crap, we're here. This is awesome. And all of it. And it was, I loved it. And
other
I love
the
rescue
used,
from that
which
moment.
Which I can confirm was thrown around like, you know,
oh, yeah.
things that you throw
not
around
inaccurate.
Like Nerf footballs at high school campuses in 1980s.
No, yeah.
It's not, it's a joke about homophobia. It's not really
a
homophobic
is.
Joke.
It is. It's just a word that would probably not be used now, but that's it. Exactly. Well, I think we've provided a lot of good context for Lisa's daughter now.
There you go.
Yeah. Yes. And I look forward to her podcast about watching 80s movies.
And it is being used in a kind of puncturing way here, which I appreciate. Again, the good-hearted nature of Bill and Ted win out in the end.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Don't they? All right, so we meet the princesses. Princesses are getting married off to... I don't even know who, but it doesn't matter. They want to be rescued.
Some dudes.
Unfortunately, some dudes. The king is there and says, put them in the Iron Maiden. And they think that's excellent because Iron
excellent.
Maiden. But it's like, no, have them killed off with their heads. And they're going
bogus.
To, again, they're going to be executed. But they're fortunately saved by our Nerf football loving pals, Billy and Socrates. Who saved them, at which point I realized I think the right way to look at this movie is to think of it as like, this is a movie like Harold and Kumar is a movie. It's that kind of movie where it's like, or Dude, Where's My Car, right? It's like, oh, just, you know, just go with
oh
it. They
God.
Got saved by Billy and, yeah. and Socrates. It's fine.
Sure.
It's all
You just
good.
Explained why I enjoy Harold and Kumar
like,
as much as I
like
do.
All those movies. I like Dude, Where's My Car too. I think they're all very funny, stupid movies. And this is also a very funny, stupid movie.
With a lot of charm.
With a lot of charm. Yeah, well, charm goes a long way with a movie like this, yeah. right?
It really
I
does.
Do have to shout out one of the princesses who is one of the classic 80s actresses, Diane Franklin, who is
yes.
awesome. Monique
Better
from Better Off Dead. Yes.
Better Off Dead.
Yep. She's recognized. Yes. I mean, you see the princesses and you're like, ah, yes. Princesses from the 80s. I know them.
Oh, I know them.
Yeah.
So we're gonna get back to them, but we don't get them now. Remember, say hi to the princesses. Give the princesses my love, something like that. He says to future.
Give our love to the Texas. Princesses.
You'll see.
Yeah. You'll see.
They are then pulled into the future. At which point, the people from the future. Do an air guitar thing that is amazing and ludicrous. My only note here is that they do it all to a very hokey power ballad,
yes.
which feels like the wrong musical choice for Bill and Ted's Utopia. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know. It's pretty
but
good,
But it's
though.
Weapons great optimistic.
Little, there's some rockin' guitar in it.
Yeah, but it's a little, I think it's a little too cheesy. I think it feels a little uncool.
Oh, it's too cheesy for this movie?
It's,
really?
Yes. I think it's a little too cheesy for this movie.
This is what's too cheesy for this movie?
I think it needs
bit?
A little more rock and roll. A little
I don't
more.
Know. I think it works. Like,
I don't think Bill and Ted have very good musical taste, though.
That's fair.
Well, theoretically, that's their song in the future, would be my guess.
Oh, like, interesting.
Surely the society based on their tenets is also based on their music.
Based on their music. Oh, boy. Well, power ballad
comment,
it is, then.
When they comment on how great the music is, you know, they're commenting on their own tunes.
Well, it felt to me like they couldn't clear a better song in the making of the movie. And so this is what we got.
I just appreciate that, like, when they show up, the chill dude just says, it's you. Everyone's chill and happy to see them.
Everyone's just, it's like they were just hanging out waiting for him to show up. And to this day, I still want the sunglasses that Clarence Clemens is wearing in this scene. To this
like,
day.
They lower them and raise them in tandem, the three important people.
Which is the other thing I love about that. Yeah. Like, who
but
are
I also
they?
Like that this is...
What are they doing? Immaterial.
This society clearly has taken in the phrases "be excellent to each other" and "party on, dudes." This is the moment when it happens, people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, this is when they coin the phrases, and I'm not even sure they even know it. The future people might not even realize it.
Yeah.
So they have no idea that this was like the first time it happened.
Well, yeah, because they're coming out with it. That is a nice moment where they're like, be excellent to each other. And everybody's like, yes. Of course. But he's just making it up in the moment, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a perfect reflection of the dichotomy between the secretly brilliant Bill S. Preston Esquire and the, you know, goofy get along guy, Ted Theodore Logan.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And party on, dude.
Party on.
Yeah, yes.
And
yes,
party on,
excellent,
dude.
Excellent.
Well, it's important to, I mean, Jason, like another movie that you and I have talked about a whole lot on The Incomparable, they're bringing balance to the Force.
Mm.
Oh, boy.
So things go haywire and there's a weird green thing in the tubes that go through time. Look, it's complicated. I'm not going to explain it to you now. If you don't understand it, you never will.
You know, I said that exact phrase to my doctor last week.
The tube that goes through time.
There's a weird green thing. It's a weird green thing in there.
It's not great. So then the pace picks up even further. They go to Vienna in 1901 and see Freud dude, Sigmund Freud. Freud dude.
Freud dude.
They start loading
Meanwhile,
up the
Napoleon
phone booth.
Napoleon has gone to Farrell's, which is,
oh, yes.
is might be oh, one of my very Farrell's favorite 80s parlor. References that people outside of this area might not even be aware of the existence of. But yeah, the whole Ziggy Piggy phenomenon, it's a change
it's real.
From what Farrell's offered, but it's basically real. They had a thing called the pig's trough,
yeah,
which was like a 6 ice cream scoop sundae with like
bananas
and just crap.
I think there's a slab of ribs in it for a while. Like
might be a bowling ball in there somewhere.
And that was a trend too. We had a different chain where I grew up, but they had the exact same thing. You could get the giant bowl of everything. And Napoleon, my note is simply Napoleon eats a lot of ice cream. Right. So much so that he's licking they give him the Ziggy Piggy Award. He's still like licking the ice cream off the table.
Off the
As
table.
They take it away, he's still trying to get like the last bit out of the bowl. It's so funny. I got to go to Farrell's for my birthday. Not as a kid. I wanted to very much as a kid, but they brought it back in Southern California. So
yes.
Like 2018, I got to go to Farrell's next to Knott's Berry Farm for my birthday. It was a surprise.
And
it
glad
was
you did while
hands
you could,
down the greatest
dead
surprise
again.
Dead again, yeah.
For my birthday.
It didn't work.
But
ever.
Yeah, man, that was the place when you had a birthday party
that
and you
was,
didn't know where else to go.
That's it.
That's where you went. You went to Farrell's and you ordered a pig's trough and you ate all that ice cream if it was going to kill you.
And then
you brought home a ribbon that says, I made a pig of myself.
Yep. And then you threw up.
Yes.
All over
and then
the
you
ribbon.
Threw up all over yourself or the car, usually.
Mm-hmm.
You're making this birthday sound so great, really.
Yeah.
So the phone booth's getting crowded because if only it was bigger on the inside, but I mean, it sort of is. But
that's ludicrous,
yeah.
Jason.
Yeah, let's not push it too far. So they get fruit, dude. They get Joan of Arc. They lure Genghis Khan into the phone booth with a Twinkie.
With a Twinkie.
Yeah. They scoop Beethoven's bench right up and carry him off while he's playing Fur Elise.
They trick Lincoln by knocking on the door and saying, Candygram.
Which I love so much.
Nice
I
touch.
Love this Lincoln, by the way. He's such a goofball. Mm-hmm. And you can imagine him being excited, not really knowing what a Candygram is, but he's willing to try.
What might that be? Who's out there? And it's kidnappers from the future.
It starts with candy. It can't be all bad. Yeah, he's into it.
So, but the antenna.
With Lincoln, we actually ended up pausing and having like a spirited debate. Would Bill and Ted send Lincoln back to be assassinated, or would they try to find another way to keep him around?
I don't think Bill and Ted would want to break the timeline, you know?
Yeah, the timeline in San Dimas that happened and already passed.
Quite honestly, yeah. I'm not sure they would have put it together.
Also, yeah, they're not aware that he gets assassinated.
Maybe we should take him back the day after the theater.
Good luck, dude. I hear there's a good show at Ford's Theater, dude.
Yeah. Yeah,
someone's going to mention it to them. But our theory was someone would mention it to them and they'd be like, oh,
bummer.
Mr. Lincoln. He's going to be shot?
What?
Dude, we have to do something about that.
I thought he was just the $5 bill, dude.
Bill and Ted 4. They're just they're going to save Lincoln.
Sure.
The antenna on top of the phone booth is broken now. Oh, no. I hope everybody's going to be okay. But wait a second. We have to cut to Napoleon. What's Napoleon up to now? Well, he's bowling with the kids who have been told to babysit Napoleon.
Bowling Napoleon.
Napoleon is very bad at bowling. They ditch him. Apparently they had an open tab or something, which I don't understand, because the guy who runs the bowling alley says, "You owe me money." And when Napoleon answers in French, basically like, they throw him out and he's banned sure. from the bowling alley. Sorry, Napoleon. What a defeat.
But, you know, Deacon's a big spender at the bowling alley, so
he's a whale at the bowling alley.
I just am surprised that they don't have to make them pay up front, that they expect them to settle the tab at the end. But, you know, these kids today.
Deacon, by the way, is an underloved character, but you got to appreciate that he's game to just take this random French guy around.
Yeah, until he isn't.
I mean,
because he does. He's just like, okay.
Napoleon is just dumped in his lap, and
my brother asked me.
Yeah, he goes for it. He takes him to the bowling alley. He takes him to to get a Ziggy Piggy, and you know, he didn't have to.
Yeah, but then they do ditch him here because
they do.
I
would too. He cheated. He cheated on his scores.
He did. He added 100 points to his score, and then even then, he doesn't know when to let go of the bowling ball and got halfway down the
He was bad at bowling and worse at scorekeeping. I mean, that's where we're at.
And he says merit a whole
lot. He does.
Didn't this maintain a PG-13 rating or a PG rating?
Not in France.
No, that's right. Where someday we will have a low-definition round where I tell you what it was called in France.
Oh, excellent. All right. So they had to fix the thing on top of the phone booth. So it's 1 million BC. There are cavemen. That's not really historically accurate, but okay. They're fixing with it, and it's beautiful because everybody's chewing gum, and they got the pudding cups that they brought with them again because they're going camping or something. They got some pudding cups in case you need some sugar. So they use the pudding cups and the gum that everybody's chewed to kind of like stick the thing back together, I think very cleverly, so that they can go to San Dimas, where they end up meeting themselves. We get to see that from the other side. George Carlin gets to ask them if they're doing okay. And then the best line in that scene, for my money, is as they go back to the phone booth, they say, "Wow, that conversation made no sense this time." I love it.
I think he said more sense.
No, I think he said no sense. Or was it more sense? I thought it was no sense.
I think it's more sense.
Either way, I love that they're commenting on the entire structure of the of the movie, which is like, oh, we did
it's
that
great.
Again.
Well, and you're seeing, you know, the second half of that conversation, and you're expecting there to be some great revelations in there that you didn't get to see the first time. But no, it's just yeah, and the fact that he told Ted to wind his watch. But in fact, Ted didn't wind his watch, and so he's reminding himself again, even though he knows he didn't wind his watch. It's great.
There's going to be more time travel shenanigans in a minute, but this is a fun time paradox that they do here. And this is where the movie basically shifts into the third act, because they go to tomorrow, which is when the report is due.
Because you have to dial up one number.
Yeah. So they go up one number to tomorrow, and this is where we get that moment where they try to introduce all the people from history with aliases. So it's like Bob Genghis Khan, Herman the Kid, Socrates Johnson, and Dennis Frood.
Dave Beethoven.
Mm-hmm. Dave Beethoven.
And then we just give up at the end. And Dennis
Abraham
Frood
Lincoln.
And Abraham Lincoln.
Bob Genghis Khan.
Come up with one.
And Abraham Lincoln. Yeah.
Bob Genghis Khan.
Bob Genghis Khan.
I don't know what cracks me up, but it's so funny. And then Socrates Johnson.
Johnson, yep. Mm-hmm. Herman the Kid. Totally different. They'll never know.
Maxine of Arc, no relation.
But to get Missy to take them to school, they have to do their chores, which leads
to
a true sign that this is a movie released in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's time for the chores montage.
Sure.
A musical montage. Everybody get ready.
Of historical figures doing chores.
This movie is chock full of montages, and I love it.
Bring back the montage, I say.
Yeah.
But this is a good one. Lots of bits where the various characters... Yes, there's another great montage later. Various characters from history are doing their chores so that they can then go... they go to the San Dimas Mall. This is where people hang out. Great. Napoleon, of course, they
where
is
you
not
can
there.
Get a hot dog on a bat. It's legally distinct.
Where's Napoleon? He's at Waterloo, the water park, paying off that joke, of course. And this is where we get again historical figures explore a 1980s mall. Joan of Arc is entranced by the aerobics instruction going on. Beethoven is rocking out with a synthesizer or two at the music store. Billy the Kid and Socrates are picking up girls. Sigmund Freud insists that sometimes a hot dog on a stick is merely a hot dog on a stick.
Yeah, let's stop here for a second, because I want to call out this very
subtle, at least to my mind. Steve Lutz interruption in the history
leave
of Steve Lutz.
Leave it to Steve.
I was leaving the
stop
opening
at
there.
The hot dog
that's
on
right.
a bat.
It's a giant corn dog on a stick
you,
that Sigmund
you
Freud
You were
is
leaving
eating.
The opening there, were you, Jason?
Yes,
you were leaving
sure
the
was.
Opening there. You're just giving Steve more to work with.
Yep. It's just this is just a tremendous, to my mind, at least for this movie, nice and subtle sight uh-huh. gag that might be my favorite thing in the movie, which is Billy the Kid and Socrates are chatting up a couple of 80s mall girls, mm-hmm. and Freud pops in and introduces himself, says they can call him Siggy.
You
and,
call
and when he
Siggy.
Appears, he's prominently holding a corn dog straight up.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
But then the girls laugh at him and his corn dog slowly
droops.
Sags forward.
And it droops. Yes.
Until it is in a sad, flaccid mm-hmm. state. Oh, it's so great. Mm-hmm. It's Freud, people.
It's Freud.
Geek.
It's Freud.
And his giant corn dog on a stick.
And his corn dog. Sometimes it's just a corn dog, though.
Sometimes a giant corn dog on a stick is just a giant corn dog on
not
a stick.
Not in this case, though. I
it's
think it's
definitely
supposed to be
not
a dick,
in this
Jason.
Case. No, no. Nope, it's not. Genghis Khan discovers the wonder of an aluminum bat, and he can wield it as a weapon. It's better than the bone or whatever that he had before.
Wow, there's a lot of phallic stuff in this.
This movie, leads to one of the best introductory scene, like one's the best introduction later when it's a pleasure to introduce to you a gentleman we picked up in medieval Mongolia in the year 1269. Please welcome the very excellent barbarian, Mr. Genghis Khan. This is a dude who 700 years ago totally ravaged China and who, we were told, 2 hours ago totally ravished Oshman Sporting Goods. Yep. And they're just so cheerful about
he knocks
totally
it. I love his intro.
He knocks the head off of the dummy and all of that
mannequin.
And he's like, yeah, beheading, I can behead things with this bat.
Yeah.
I love it.
Into the basketball hoop, which is just so funny. Yep. Every time.
And all that stuff that he got to do in the sporting goods store, Al Leong, he was in Lethal Weapon, he was in Die Hard, he was in Big Trouble in Little China, he was in They Live, he was in like every TV show in the 80s, he was in Magnum, he was in TJ Hooker, he was in like everything. He was in Last Action Hero, also covered here on The Incomparable. Mm. And then like he just kind of disappeared for a little while, and then he popped up all of a sudden on Deadwood, and I was like, oh, thank God. I could have checked IMDb to find out he's
Wait,
not dead, but I'm
he
glad he's not dead.
Wait, was he the one who... Moises?
Mm-hmm.
Really, is he swedging?
Yes, I believe so.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that.
Genghis Khan.
And I, oh my gosh.
He blew Lisa's mind live in the middle of the show.
By the way, what is Lincoln doing all this time? He's getting his picture taken in an old style photo booth. And then right. when they're done, he says, okay, I'll need the hat.
It's my hat.
I love it.
I'm going to go on record here as saying that what we get next is one of the all-time great montages of film history.
Mm-hmm.
As the various historical figures wreak havoc in the mall.
Oh, yeah.
To the sounds
I
of,
love every frame
Joan of Arc
this
kicks
sequence.
Off the kicks the aerobics instructor off the stage. Beethoven draws a crowd while getting down. Genghis Khan adds a football helmet and pads and a skateboard and does, I would say, the most excellent trampoline move one will ever see.
Oh, it's solid.
Where the skateboard goes under the trampoline as he hits the trampoline, does a flip, and lands back on the trampoline. You know why? Because Genghis Khan... is a cool dude.
Because Genghis Khan, that's why.
He's a cool dude.
I mean, it's not really a montage because it's in real time, but I'll allow it. It's particularly mm-hmm. because it is set to what is indisputably Extreme's best song, Play With Me, which is so perfect here because it's got
yes.
that sort of classically based Nuno Betancourt guitar solo.
You can
solo.
Hear the Aquanet in that song, and I love it.
That's right. It's on the string, so you actually literally can hear it.
There's a lot of hair metal.
Yeah, no, it's it. And I love the fact that, you know, they're all getting arrested for their various crimes. And Genghis Khan, of course, has murdered a mannequin with a baseball bat. Abe Lincoln is believed to have stolen the photo studio's prop hat and beard.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, Beethoven's crime is that he attracted too many customers
that
to the Wurlitzer
store.
He was
too awesome on the demo hardware.
Too awesome. Yeah, that's right.
I love the increasing annoyance on the worker's face as he's like tapping his watch. He's like, got to take my break. There's all these damn customers here now, though. And
everybody's
he gets the police.
Excited
his
about
job would
price.
Be great if it weren't for the it's customers. Well, oh, wait, that's a different movie.
Okay, so my question is, how many mall cops does this mall employ? Because there's an army of mall cops that are mobilized to stop the figures of history.
I mean, San Dimas is well known as the center of mall cop, mm. You know.
Mall cop academy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a different set of 80s movies that we're going to talk about later.
Mm. I just feel like that guy immediately closed. He pulled down the little grate in front of the store and made all the people who had gathered at the Wurlitzer store go away so he could go have his lunch.
I guess that what they're trying to do there is it's a little bit like in Wayne's World, it's a little bit like playing Stairway to Heaven on the guitar. It's like some dude walks in and he can play the piano and he's just going to stay here for 30 minutes and do a concert. And I'm not selling any pianos.
And not buy anything.
Right? I think that's probably what they're going for there. But yes, again, it is literally we've drawn a crowd to our store because this guy is using our products to make incredible music. Perhaps this is good, but
the only time in history, except for 5 minutes ago when Beethoven showed up, that somebody willingly walked into that store.
I know. And this is why what I said before, I'll repeat here, which is the guest bits are so great. Like this is the thing that makes this movie
so great,
fly.
You might even say.
So crates. This is what makes this movie fly is that you get these figures from history and they are delightfully either being their, you know, stereotype from history or put in our modern era doing surprising things like Joan of Arc taking over the aerobics class, that it's like, what? It's just, it's delightful. And there's so many of them that when you get tired of one little bit with one of the characters, they just go on to the next one. We'll come back to Beethoven
it
later.
It doesn't matter if you're not liking that particular character because you're only going to be there another 30 seconds and then we'll go on to the next person.
Did you not like that bit where Genghis Khan finds an aluminum bed? Just wait, we'll see him later. And there's a trampoline. Okay, it's fine. Like, it'll be fine.
He can skateboard too.
Yeah,
he's so talented.
But they can't ice skate, and that's what finally gets our heroes caught. Is they're slipping on the ice.
Not a lot of ice in that part of Mongolia. I guess
to the police station, the mall cops / police force take it to the police station where Freud is analyzing a detective.
Where all of them are still doing exactly the same stuff they were doing at the mall, which is just being themselves.
Exactly. At the school, the endless assembly of the history oral reports just continues endlessly to go on. That's happening. And then we get that moment where we've had the little tidbit that was placed there that Ted's dad doesn't have his keys?
Yes.
Yes.
And he blames Ted. And Ted's like, no, I didn't do it. And then they have this moment where they need his keys. And he's like, yeah, my dad lost his keys. And they say, and this is one, we've talked about the phone booth being a very Doctor Who thing. This is the most Stephen Moffat Doctor Who thing in the whole movie. In fact, he used it in a comedy Doctor Who bit that he did for charity too, which is, oh, we need a thing. I'll use my time machine later to go back in time and get the thing and bring it here and stash it right back here where it'll be ready for me. Okay, cool, dude. And then they go, and there it is. There are the keys. It's such a great moment. It's like, we just have to remember to do it later and we'll leave it right here. And so they do that. They do that bit a couple of times. And I think it's great because it is pointing out the sheer absurdity of time travel. But, you know, show me where it says on the rules that they can't do this. I guess we have to allow it. It's great.
And I love that your mind, since you know these two guys are idiots, the first thing you think is they're absolutely going to forget to
that
do
they're
going to
reach
things.
And there's no keys there.
And then they immediately address that concern by saying it. You know, it's like, oh, we got to make sure that we remember to do that. And I think Ted actually says, we must have because it happened. And you're like, oh, yeah, right. They did. Yeah. So I guess it's all OK.
That's right.
They must remember to do it.
That's right. Otherwise, it would be a paradox and we can't have that. Everything happens, right? Everything that's going to happen does happen. They don't change it. So therefore, there it is. So anyway, they break them out. It's great. And instead, we can have the 1988 World Tour at the very end where Bernie Casey is like, oh, well, Bill and Ted aren't here. They fail. Everybody else can go home early. But no, they can't. We have our big production number where they are presenting the 1988 World Tour of History. And they introduce the various historical figures who appear. Socrates and Freud.
Billy the Kid shoots out a spotlight to quiet the crowd, which is totally cool and chill in a high school auditorium.
Yeah, well, you know.
Absolutely fine.
In 1988.
In 1988, it would have been fine.
Well, they probably figure it's a special effect, right? They don't think it's real. It's a piece of Billy the Kid. So they've rigged this thing to be a pretend gunshot, right? Sure. Sure, that's it.
By the way, if you're wondering how they managed to instantly put together a pretty impressive AV package with multiple synchronized spotlights and musical cues and stuff, just remember they can come back later and set that all up.
They set it all up back in time. That's right. You got it. There's a lot. Right. Freud appears and there's a moment where he does his Freud thing and it's like, whoa, it's a good moment of like, well, Freud, you blew my mind. And then Lincoln does his abridged version of the Gettysburg Address, which ends with imparting, I would say, a remarkable amount of gravitas on the theme of the movie, which is be excellent to each other. And we're like, oh, Lincoln, you brought it home. At which point he says, and party on, dudes. And you go, all right, Lincoln, you got me. Okay.
It's great.
It's just that's the juxtaposition of Bill and Ted. Again, yes, the wise words of Bill and the silly words of Ted. But Lincoln brings it home. Lincoln nails it. At which point, yay, the day
these
is saved.
Historical figures have learned so much from our protagonists.
They have. They've loosened up a little bit.
They've learned about Nerf footballs and
aerobics and Twinkies. What more do you get from the 80s than aerobics and Twinkies?
The Ziggy Piggy. Like, Napoleon's going to bring that useful knowledge back to him.
And Rufus returns and brings the princesses. They're part of the band in the future, so we might as well get started. And they begin to play, and you think it's going to be the triumphant performance, but of course, this movie knows what it is. They're terrible. And as George Carlin says, well, they get better. And that's the end of the movie.
Which is a great way to end it. Not sure how else you'd end it.
Because there's still morons.
With a wry George Carlin
trust
line.
Trust it. They'll be better later, but not right now.
They do get better.
Yeah. And the princesses apparently are just... I actually wondered if he was going to say something like, oh, well, they were going to get executed, so I pulled them out of time and brought them forward in time. Because that would break the timeline, right? But... who cares? It's just, again...
That's how it
it's
happened.
All fine. That's how it happened. That's right.
That's
just like
happened.
How they put in the light show in the auditorium. They just went back
right,
and did it.
Right.
So they would have it.
Yeah, I did want to say that the one thing this adds to the sort of standard time travel tropes is this conceit that despite the fact that they're bouncing around in their time machine, like the main timeline that's going on in San Dimas sort of continues to chug along, which I find fun. It's an interesting, it's the sort of thing that one of those time travel ideas that you think about it for a while and then like it just sort of makes your head hurt. So you stop. But it makes zero sense, even in the context of this movie, but it is fun. Like, obviously, that it's not a problem for them to come back later and set things up at the police station, for instance, even though that's after the main
and take a minute
occurred.
To type the little note to themselves, which
yeah,
I appreciate.
They're trying to give him a ticking clock, essentially, right? But that's
right.
Fine. I guess there's like every day has its own access point and that moves forward in time. But
yes,
could you not come back and just do it then again later? And it doesn't it's just a movie. It's fine.
And in the future, Clarence Clemens announces it's time. Their failure is imminent, you know. So even there in 2688 are aware of the real timeline that's happening in San Dimas, California.
Yeah.
Which
I guess.
It makes no sense.
I mean,
it really doesn't.
I watched a lot of Doctor Who, Steve. It makes perfect sense.
Okay, sure.
In the okay. Same way that Doctor Who makes perfect sense.
What doesn't make sense is the fact that Ted wears a Van Hagar t-shirt throughout the whole thing instead of a Van Halen t-shirt.
We talked at the beginning of the episode about what morons they are, Steve.
Fair point. It's a little hard to take having to look at Sammy Hagar's face for the entire movie.
So what have we learned?
So much,
somehow,
dude.
The best chronological astronauts are just sweet morons who will not overthink the issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if you had told me, well, we're going to do a movie and what it's going to be is that a couple of morons go through history and they bring historical figures to the present day because they need to ace their history final and shenanigans occur, I'd be like, okay. And that's basically what this movie is, and the answer is yeah, it's sweet and good natured and ridiculous, and all the little individual characters are awesome and funny and deployed really well. And although it's, I would say the first 15-20 minutes of it is kind of slow and the dialogue is clunky and it's not great. It just keeps picking up speed. until at one point it just literally, you know, they go back in time and it takes flight. And then at that point, it's just nonsense the rest of the way. And it's all good. It's all funny.
I just say that their stilted patter is just background noise at that point. So it ceases to be a problem. But it is definitely a little hard to get over in the initial stages of the movie. But then you don't care.
I think that any writers who write themselves into the movie as stupid waiter and ugly waiter and serve Napoleon Bonaparte a sundae deserve a little bit of a pass.
Is that who those
first 20
guys
minutes?
Are?
That's who those
that's
guys
exactly
are.
I saw stupid waiter and ugly waiter in the credits and I was like, oh, that's funny. And I could not think of where that was.
Yeah, because those names pop up again later in the credits.
Makes sense.
Good old stupid waiter and ugly waiter. They're the real Bill and Ted.
I think Socrates is my favorite. He's just so game for everything. He's
gleeful.
So happy.
He's having
he
a great
hilarious
time.
It's that Sigmund Freud gets called a geek.
Geek!
Just geek!
And, you know, he possibly second only to Deacon as far as characters in this movie, you know, who I've already expressed my love for. Although I didn't mention the great line where they meet him at the Little League field and Ted says, Deacon, do you realize you stranded one of Europe's greatest leaders in San Dimas? To which his response is, he was a dick.
Dick. Yeah, I love that.
Yep. Yeah, not wrong. Not wrong.
He was accurate, historically accurate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Napoleon wasn't that short, but he was a dick. So
he was a dick.
Deacon's going to get a 5 on AP World History. Mm-hmm.
Good job, Deacon.
Oh, the history scores in San Dimas are going through the roof for the foreseeable future, I think.
You just know the rest of the high school students like, oh, so how do I top this?
I want to know how Joan of Arc incorporates aerobics exercise mm-hmm. into her training regimen when she's returned.
Oh, see, that's another one where you have the ethical dilemma.
Yeah,
do
I know.
You return her so she can get... Yeah. This is, I now want some university somewhere to do the thought experiments that go into Bill and Ted messing with the timeline. Like, I have questions.
Well, and there's the question of like, could you use your time travel to save them at the moment where history records them as dying and all that? And there's, I've seen at least 2 different TV shows with that premise.
Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. See, it's okay because Joan fell out of her armor at the last second.
She did. Yeah. She fell off the stake at the last minute, leaving the fire behind. Yep.
I fell out of my armor, dude.
And she's okay. All right, cool. Come to the future with us. Yep. That's it.
I have loved everything about this movie. It was showing in a theater where I grew up. It had just come out and we didn't really have anything better to do and went and watched it. And I loved this movie beginning to end from the minute I saw it. Just like I said, I watched the cartoon. I ate the cereal. I bought the cereal to get more of the little cassette holder phone booths. I was so excited about the third one. I was part of the world record air guitar attempt that they did that actually succeeded. So
Kelly,
like,
every time we talk, I learn more about you and it is all just fascinating.
And like, I have, like, every time anybody who's listened to me on any other podcast knows that if it's my show, I sign off with be excellent to each other on every episode. And there's a reason for that, because first of all, I really love this movie. It's like, well, like I said earlier, I think it's a really good rule to live by, you know, and just like the fundamental kindness in this movie and the fact that like they do stop and have a snack break, you know, and they do have pudding cups for everybody and they do like check in to make sure everybody's doing all right, you know, and all of the little pieces of that that make them useful idiots, even, you know, we know they're idiots, but they're sort of useful idiots in a way and not mean or anything like that. And like, this came out right around the time that like Married with Children was on TV and like, let's be mean to each other, but funny about it was like really getting on, was really on the upswing. And so this really stood out compared to a lot of other stuff that was being released at the time. And that's always one of the things that I have always really liked about it.
Yeah, this movie screams freshman year of college to me. Mm-hmm. I think we had one videotape in my dorm and it had this and Skin Deep on it. The Blake Edwards movie that the only thing anybody ever remembers about is the glow of the dark condom fight, which is pretty great, I have to say. But man, we must have watched this movie like 600 times that freshman year. And it is just, it is the film soundtrack, the film track to my freshman year. And I was a little concerned that having not seen it probably in 20 years, it was not going to hold up that well. But it's just so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Like dumbness is timeless.
I will point out that I've watched it a lot more the last couple of years than I did the few years before that. But yeah.
Seconding the colleginess, Bill and Ted 1 and 2 were comfort food for me and a group of my friends. Like, we could always order the crummiest, cheapest Hungry Howie's pizza and just while away an afternoon watching both movies back to back, we would go, oh, we're going to watch Excellent Adventure and maybe we'll watch Bogus Journey. And then we're like, well, of course you got to watch Bogus Journey because Station.
Yes.
And
Station.
And, you know, like we lost one of our friend group far too young, like 12, 13 years ago now. And in the email thread that went across all of us, one of the things that that one of us did to celebrate Kirk was bootleg the Station track that was never on any official version of the soundtrack that you couldn't get in any way other than watching the movie.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it's a comfort food movie in so many ways, because even 30 plus years on, as we said, there are few things that are really, really creaky or more creaky than other far creakier movies of the time. And what else was I going to say? Oh, San Dimas High School Football rules and 69 dudes.
I think what you were saying is that it's timeless. Huh?
Yeah.
Whoa.
I think you're right, Jason. I think everything's different, but the
idiocy
same.
Is timeless.
Things are more moderner than before, bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, smaller.
Smaller.
Yep.
It's computers. And then, you know, San Dimas High School
football. San Dimas High School football rules.
at the end of the day, I think we can all agree, San Dimas High School football rules.
That's what's important.
I just love that his train of thought just drifts off and he just shouts, computers!
Computers!
And that's why.
He's giving keynotes at sales conferences now.
Sure.
You know, we make fun of that guy and we repeat that, but it's like, it wouldn't be funny if that weren't so incredibly true to life.
So, yeah.
I've experienced so many class presentations exactly like that.
In my high school, that absolutely happened in our school-wide oral history report day-long event. Who among us can say that that's not?
Wait, you mean you didn't have the all-day history report extravaganza at your high school?
I did. And then the football player just said that football ruled.
And apparently San Dimas High School does a pretty good business in San Dimas High School football rules t-shirts.
I'm sure
even though
do.
This was not filmed anywhere near San Dimas.
No. I'm sure
some Texas high school was forced to put something academic in the pep rallies to be allowed to continue doing the pep rallies because they became too much of a football school, and so they inserted some school history reports. And then everybody got back to just talking about football, which is all that anybody cared about.
So Socrates would come out and then they would cheer and then he'd go back off again.
What's up, my dudes? My name is Socrates. AKA Alex Hardiman, wide receiver for the high school football team.
That's right.
What's up?
All we are is dust in the wind. Goodbye.
Peace.
I also really enjoy the other presentations, like the one that ends with, well, in her day, Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. Perhaps today she would say, let them eat fast food, which is very much the way you end a high school presentation.
I thought that was really good. I was like, she's giving me an A. She's giving me an A.
Absolutely.
Yeah. outside of the setting, those presentations were very true to high school life.
Yeah. Well, and then you've got like the super big man on campus who's got a little more together than the San Dimas High School football rules guy. And he just ends with I know I do. And like, you could just hear like all of the cheerleaders swooning.
And that's why he's the class president or whatever.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. He's better at it.
Now working at Oshman Sporting Goods.
Uh-huh. That's right. Well, there's a mess there you got to clean up.
Somebody's
got to do it. It's like Genghis Khan went through here. Hmm. Yeah. Just like that.
Weird.
So for an end to the summer of time travel, this has been great.
Wait, what?
Or is it the beginning?
Greetings, my excellent friends.
I feel like it's always somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Summer of time travel. It begins now and ends before.
Man, if Unjustly Maligned still existed, I would do Bogus Journey, which I think is unjustly maligned.
I liked it, but I mean, William Sadler's death and the twister with death is like one of the greatest things I've ever seen in a movie, quite honestly. I don't remember much else about
twister
the movie.
Twister with death is, so other good. Than twister is the with best. Death.
I've still never seen it.
Oh, Steve.
Steve.
William Sadler's death is as like straight up Seventh Seal death.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen him, surely, and I've seen bits and pieces of it, but...
Yeah, right. Okay, you saw the commercials, Steve. That doesn't count.
It's good.
Seeing the commercials doesn't count
as
participating.
That's pretty much all I need to see.
Yeah.
You know, I went to Rome.
All right,
sure. You know, I've seen Italy. I went to Rome and, you know, stayed at the hotel.
It's the you know, it's so tranquil.
I went to the castle of King Henry.
All right, well, that wraps up this edition of The Incomparable's Summer of Time Travel. I want to thank my guests for being so excellent and taking this excellent journey with me today. Moises Chuyon, thank you.
Jason, remember, get a tape recorder and set it for 2:13, dude. Because that's something you can totally do with a tape recorder.
Yep. That's story check. Well, they're going to go to the future and get a good timed tape recorder and then bring it back to the past. It's complicated. Lisa Schmeiser, thank you.
I don't have a good quote and I regret it. Thank you
that's
for having me.
Go back in time.
Come back later. Fix it.
Whoa, Ted, you're
just,
alive.
Just go with San Dimas High School football rules. It always applies.
Oh, I should have done that. Computers.
Kelly Gamont, thank you.
Gentlemen, we're history.
And Steve Lutz, thank you.
Thank you, Jason. This has been a most unusual podcast.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We will see you next time. Until then, be excellent to each other. And party on, dudes.